Okay, so, and presumably he wrote it near the end of his life, which is where we're going to turn to now. So we're going to look at the situation. When and where was the book written from? And we know from critical analysis of the text, from this textual criticism thing, and also from outside evidence, that this was the last of the Gospels written. Okay, so Mark was written first. And then there's a little bit of debate as to which came next. Most likely Matthew, and then Luke, and then John came a little bit of time after all of them. But when exactly the gospel was written, we don't exactly know. It doesn't give us a date. But one thing we know for sure was that it had to have been written and in distribution prior to 125 AD. Okay, so if Jesus died in 30 AD, the gospel had to have been written and in distribution by 125 AD. And the reason why we know that it had to be written there is because we have found a copy, or a portion of a copy. Here it is. This is called from the Rylands Library. It is called P52. They identify the papyrus, P standing for papyrus. 52 is the number that it is. And this right here, on the one side of it, is a copy of John's Gospel, John chapter 18, verse 31 to 33. And if you flip it over on the other side, which we don't have a picture of it, but that's 37 to 38. And when they dated this copy of it, it came to a date of 125 AD. Okay. And incidentally, the first real full manuscript, like the full copy of John's Gospel we have, is around 175 AD, a full copy of it. Which is, I mean, we could go into this, but the textual, like, manuscript evidence behind the scriptures is unbelievable, how much is there and how close it is to the sources. There's not a book that's like that, okay, in that way, but that's a whole other point of teaching altogether.
That's his original copy.
Yeah, well, that would have been a copy dated from 125 AD. It wasn't necessarily written by John. It wouldn't have been written by John. It was a manuscript copier that wrote it down. But that's the earliest copy that we have of it dated to 125. And so, obviously, then, the gospel had been written by that point, and it had been in distribution by that point. So that's why they say, then, 125 is the latest, but probably more likely the latest date is more in the neighborhood of 110 AD. It was the gospel was written. Okay, any questions about that? But this so far, we'll go on with the date a little bit more. But any questions about the date so far? No. This is actually, this P52 is the earliest copy of the New Testament, earliest example of the New Testament that we have. So John's Gospel is actually the earliest manuscript evidence that we have of any New Testament book. Does that make sense how I said that? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. But many people assume that it was written considerably before 110, and one of the reasons why they do is because, remember how at the last class I talked about how in 66 to 70 AD, how there was this significant war in Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And the wiping out of the temple, the Great Revolt, we called it, right? Remember that? Well, people think it's strange that John could write a whole gospel after the fact and make no allusions to that event. Right? Not even a hint of it happening in there. So people go, well, something as significant as that, and he doesn't even in parenthesis say anything about it. And so they say to themselves, it had to have been written before 66 to 70 AD, maybe 60 to 65. So that'd be kind of the earliest date on it. So Jesus dies around 30. The earliest date people put is 60 to 65. But that said, okay, most people still hold to a date more of the neighborhood of like 85 to 95 AD. They kind of split the difference.
What do you know what their explanation is for those who do date it after the destruction of the temple as to why he wouldn't mention it?
Well, just that he's writing, the reason why they say that is because, well, he's writing a book that takes place before any of that happened. So there's no point in saying anything. He's trying to put the reader into the mind of Jesus and his experience in Palestine in that day,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's saying, well, why do we talk about this? The only reason why he would ever do it is it would be like kind of a parenthesis allusion to, and this is what Jesus, you know, and what Jesus said here was fulfilled when this happened in 66 or whatever. You know?
It's funny, if we were ready, we definitely would.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
No question.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, if this is true, let's say that we split the difference, and let's say it happens sometime around 85 to 95 AD. This is where we get into the situation. Kind of an interesting little portrait of the writing appears, because we know from Irenaeus again that that John dies in 98 AD. So if 85 to 90 is kind of the range that most people put it in, that means he wrote it toward the end of his life, right?
What's AD?
98 AD. So he's getting close to the end of his life, and then he writes this gospel. And this is kind of where this portrait comes to life then. We know that at some point in John's life, that and perhaps he was fleeing the Great Revolt or whatever, but we know he moves to this Asia, or this area called Asia Minor. And we know that he moves here, and most likely within that, it's to the city of Ephesus. So he moves to Ephesus in Asia Minor. And the reason why we know that he moved here is, one, because of the extra-biblical writings, like Irenaeus said that he moved to the area, but also because his letters in the book of Revelation are all pastoral letters written to the churches of Asia Minor. Right? So he's the pastor of this area. And in Acts chapter, you can read this later on, but in Acts chapter 18, we read actually of the birth of the churches in that area. The churches were started by Paul, along with these two proteges of his, Aquila and Priscilla. Actually, more rightly, they were started by Aquila and Priscilla, and Paul kind of came and built on their foundation, right? So then sometime later, maybe 20 years later, John comes and moves in and becomes the pastor of the area, perhaps after Paul himself was executed. So there's this idea then. John perhaps moves, or he moves to Asia Minor for sure, and most likely to the main city, which was the city of Ephesus, okay? From here, he's going to write the gospel. Let's look at a couple of pictures, first of all, of Ephesus, so you get a sense of where this was happening. So this is the area known as Asia Minor. And it's Turkey today, right? And this is the capital city, the largest city of the region, Ephesus. And here is the other churches, the other six other churches of Asia Minor that the opening letter to Revelation addresses these churches. This little dot out here in the middle identifies the island of Patmos, which is where, what happened in Patmos?
Come on, guys.
Holy crap.
John. Go to John. We're putting...
Poor. Whoever taught Revelation.
Poor retention. He's like, come on, give me some...
Exactly?
Yeah. Yeah, John went to prison there at the end of his life where he dies. And writes the letter of Revelation. Revelation is the last thing he's going to write, even after John's gospel, okay? So let's look at, here's a couple of pictures of Ephesus then, this city that he's living in. Here's the theater that's still there today. The ruins of Ephesus are like no other in Turkey. They're incredible. Here's the theater that's still there today. So all of this would have been very well known. It was a port city. Today it's all been silted in, but it was a port city in John's day. And here's the library. This library was in the process of being built during the time that John was there, and probably most likely completed by the time he was there. So this significant library was being built, the greatest library in the area. And then the Artemis and her temple. The city of Ephesus was around 400,000 people. It was one of the major cities in the region. And at the very heart of it was this temple for the Greek goddess Artemis. And you can see her here, the icons that they found of her. They still dig up icons of her. She was the twin of, I think she was the twin, yes, let's call her the twin of Apollo. Yeah. And she was, as you can see, multi-breasted, because everybody wants a multi-breasted woman, right? And she was responsible for fertility, right? But she had this enormous temple cult that was devoted to her, and she had the largest temple in the region that was devoted to her. It was, let's see, I've got the numbers over here. It was 115 meters long by 55 meters wide, three times the size of the Parthenon in Greece. Unbelievable, huge 50-foot marble columns that went all throughout it. And it was one of the great wonders of the ancient world. Okay, so here's what the guy that wrote about the ancient wonders, or identified the ancient wonders, his name was Antipater of Sidon, and here's what he wrote about the house of Artemis. He said, "I have set eyes on the wall of lofty Babylon, which is a road for chariots, and the statue of Zeus by the Alpheus, and the hanging gardens, and the colossus of the sun, and the huge labor of the high pyramids, and the vast tomb of Mausolus, but when I saw the house of Artemis that mounted to the clouds, those other marvels lost their brilliancy, and I said, lo, apart from Olympus, the sun never looked on one so grand." So this enormous, he said, of all the ancient wonders, Artemis's temple was the greatest of them all. And it was in the heart of Ephesus. Today, one tiny little column still stands, and they've put it back up because it had all fallen down. The whole thing, basically, is gone. Okay. But this, you can imagine, this huge temple cult, it taints everything of the people in the region. Their whole lives are devoted to Artemis. It has a huge economy built around her. Everybody in Asia Minor was thinking about Artemis. In the midst of this, John writes a gospel about Jesus the Christ. Okay? So, and that's, we'll bear that in the back of your mind. So as I said, from Ephesus, he goes there, he writes these letters to the Church of Asia Minor, 1, 2, and 3 John, presumably, and they all predate the gospel. But then appearing, it seems like getting toward the end of his life, John begins to look beyond his own time. And realizing that the church in his area that he was pastoring was going to need a lasting witness about Jesus, because he knew, I'm dying, and I'm the one that saw and touched and all the rest of that, but I'm dying, so I need to write this down. And so he writes, along perhaps with other people, he begins to write this story about the life of Jesus. Perhaps it happened in stages over many editions, crafting this picture of Jesus. And it's assumed that the audience then that he had in mind was a very mixed audience. There was Jews that were living in the area, because after the Great Revolt, Jews were scattered all over the region. So there was Jews that were living in the area. He would have been pastoring a church, pastoring these churches with Jews in them. But there was also all sorts of Greeks that lived in them. Greeks that at one time had worshipped at the temple of Artemis. And so he writes this gospel then to help these people understand who Jesus is. And then after that, he's imprisoned in Patmos, and from there he writes the letter of Revelation prior to his death in 98. Okay? Any further questions about that? No? You good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're starting to get deeper now. Purpose. Why did he write the book? Any ideas?
Because they needed like a first-hand witnesses.
Yeah. Yeah. They needed first-hand witnesses of Jesus, for sure. Yeah, it's more, even more specific than that. Look at what he says in chapter 20. Turn to chapter 20. One of the reasons why they think that it was written in many stages is because this last little section actually makes a perfect conclusion to the book. So people say maybe chapter 21 was something that he then put on later on to describe something else. Okay, but you'll see this. This is what he writes in the last verses, chapter 20, verse 30. It says here, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing that you may have life in his name, right? So clearly, what is the intention that John says of the gospel?
That we believe in Jesus.
Yes, that we would believe, right? And this is going to be one of these words that we're going to see over and over and over again in the gospel. It's one of John's key themes. He's constantly drawing us towards belief. All of Jesus' interactions, all of the stories that are about him are written in such a way to constantly pull us towards decision. Do we really believe in Jesus? Do we believe that he is who he says he is? Jesus uses these seven statements about himself throughout the gospel. They are called the I am statements, right? I am the life. I am the light. I am the living water. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. On they go. I am the resurrection. These I am statements. He's saying, this is who I am. And John writes about them in such a way as to say, do we really believe this? It's luring us in. It's an evangelistic book is what it's intentioned for. Calling us to believe in Jesus. But more importantly, it's actually asking us a more nuanced question, isn't it? What is the more nuanced question? Do we believe that
Jesus
is the Christ? Okay, go back to January. I was teaching you about Jesus the Christ. This is what John really wants. He doesn't want us just to believe that Jesus was a good man, a prophet, a teacher, a miracle worker. He wants us to believe specifically that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is, what's the Christ? The Messiah. He wants us to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the climax of all the Old Testament aspirations. Remember how we talked about this last time? The Old Testament is the long story that precedes Jesus. It builds toward him, and the story narrows down to this idea that coming into the world was a Messiah. Right? And John wants us to read this gospel and identify him, Jesus, as that one that the Old Testament looked forward to. You tracking with that? You got it? Okay.
Any idea what like Jews and I forget what the other religions are that believe in the Bible but don't believe that Jesus was
the Christ?
Christ.
Mm-hmm.
What, like when they come across this, any idea what they how they change that or twist it or whatever?
Well, I mean, they're looking at this and go, okay, John tells us he is the Christ, but we disagree.
Yeah. You know?
So
what was that?
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the Jews and why they disagree with that last time, but that's a whole other story unto itself. Okay, so he's writing this book to say that Jesus is the Christ, the one that the Old Testament told us to expect, but that brings up another thing altogether, right? Because John is writing this to, who did we say he was writing this to? A mixed audience, right? To
Greeks and Jews.
To Greeks and Jews. So obviously, right, the Jewish reader, they're going to be able to read and pick up on all of these links that go back into the Old Testament. Because John's gospel, I meant to say that earlier on, but I didn't say that. But when John is writing the gospel, we'll see this in a little bit, he has all of these like tentacles, these links that go back to Old Testament references in order to help us clearly identify Jesus as the Christ. Right? So when the Jewish reader is reading this, we'll see this in a little bit, he's going to pick up on these things, or she'll make great sense of this. But the Gentile reader, well, those things will mean nothing to them, right? Like us. Exactly. Perfect. That's a perfect example. But here's where we already pick up on the kind of the genius of the book, the whole, you know, shallow enough for a baby to swim around in and deep enough for an elephant to drown in. Because even then, like us, the Gentile reader can read this gospel and have a really profound experience with Jesus. Come to see Jesus and understand Jesus as being someone who is very significant, even the Savior of the world. But the Jewish reader, on the other hand, he or she, with her understanding of the Old Testament and all of these links, is going to be able to swim out into something so much deeper and so much richer in meaning, right? Because they'll be able to see, oh, this link to the Old Testament, now I see what John is trying to tell us about Jesus in that regard. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so an example. I'll give you one example, and then we'll look at another example in greater detail after the break, which we'll go to here in a couple of minutes. So do you remember last time when I was teaching here, and I was talking about John 2? It was the sermon that I gave, actually, on the Sunday night. And John 2 is the story of Jesus turning the water into wine. Do you remember any of that? Who remembers any of that teaching at all that I gave that night? Okay, yeah. So John 2, I'll give you a little bit of recap on it, right? John 2, you can turn that if you want to. Just a short little story, verse 1 to 12. John 2 is kind of Jesus' first miracle. I keep on writing it's his coming out party, but that's probably not the best expression for this story here. But it's in my notes all over the place. Like, I got to come up with a new one than that. But it's in the brain now. Okay, so Jesus is having this first miracle, and he turns water into wine using these Jewish ceremonial jars. Do you remember this now? You remember this? Okay. And for the unaided Gentile reader, they're going to come across and read this and go, like you and I, on a first pass, and they're going to go, wow, that's amazing. Jesus, what it's saying here, he's clearly a miracle worker. He's going to do incredible works, those things, and he's cares about these intimate details of people's life, and they're going to have a significant encounter with Jesus. But for the Jewish reader, they're going to read this, and they're going to begin to identify all of these links, even in the beginning, that John is putting back into the Old Testament, right? They're going to read and go, huh, ceremonial jars. What do ceremonial jars mean? And they're empty. Well, we know what ceremonial jars are for us. They're the way that we find cleansing. They're the way that we cleanse ourselves in worship, symbolically cleanse ourselves from sin. but they're empty here. They're saying these old Jewish things are empty, but Jesus comes along and he fills them up. He fills them with something. Maybe Jesus is saying that he's going to fill these things up with significant things that we need. And then it takes place at a wedding. Well, when we know that in the Old Testament, when the Old Testament talked about the coming of the Messiah, that his coming was going to be like a groom coming to gather a bride for his people. And wait a second, he's filling these things up with wine. Well, we know that Amos talks about that the day of the Messiah, when the Messiah comes, it will be like wine running down from the mountainside. You see how they're going to begin to pull out all of these links, right? Saying, could Jesus really be the Messiah? Could he be the groom that we were told to expect? Could he be the one that Amos said? Because when Amos said the Messiah was coming, the Christ was coming, it'd be like wine coming down from the mountains. And Jesus' first miracle is turning water into wine at a wedding. In these old Jewish jars, which are empty, Jesus is now filling up, saying, I've come to bring something even better. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. See how much of a more profound experience that reader's going to have? You tracking? You look like you are. You're doing good. Okay, here's the toolbox. When reading the gospel, you need to ask this question of every story. What is this seeking to tell me about Jesus? This is the first thing that John wants you to consider when you're reading the gospel. It's what every gospel actually wants you to consider. Lots of times people, they make a mistake. They get hung up on the side characters. So they read the gospel and they're like, oh, look at what it tells me about Peter. Look at what it tells me about John and what John's doing. And therefore, then, I can live my life like Peter is living his life. That's not the primary point of the gospel. In the gospel, there is one three-dimensional character every time. There is one round character, to use literary terms. The one round character is who? Jesus. And all the rest of the characters are flat characters. They are there to help us understand who Jesus is. So that's not to say that we can't learn things about approaching Jesus through Mary and through Martha and through Peter and through all these other people. We can learn things. But it's just saying, let that be secondary. First of all, live your life through these people, trying to figure out, or you see through these people, trying to say, what is this story trying to teach me about Jesus? Okay? That's the first thing you want to do when read the gospel. Every story, what does this thing want to tell me about Jesus? The second thing is, the more you know about the long story, and I'll help you with this in a minute after the break, but the more you know about the long story, remember what I'm referencing the long story? The Old Testament and all of the institutions of Israel. The more you know about those things, that will be the way that you will get out into the deeper end. You can't get out into the deep end without knowing those things. But when you know them, like what the ceremonial jars are for, what this thing about wine is, the more you know those things, the more you'll make sense of it. Follow the clues that the text is going to give you, and you'll get out there. And I'll talk to you after the break about how that looks and how you do that. But I just want to tell you right now that you live in a time of unprecedented capacity in this regard, because you have something called the internet. So when you're sitting there going, ceremonial jars, maybe this is a clue that will take me out into the deep end, you go to that thing called Google, you enter in Jewish ceremonial jars, you hit enter, and it comes back with all sorts of information about Jewish ceremonial jars. And you read that information, and you soak that information in, and then with that information, you read the story, and you think to yourself, now, how do these things blend together? And when you do that, you will be as smart as me. Smarter, actually. Then you realize, I have no secrets. All I have is the internet. That actually should be my source at the beginning that I cite. Source number one, internet. Yeah. All right? So afterwards, we'll come back to the structure of it. And you'll be good. I wanted to say this earlier on, too, that the further we go in over the next few days teaching, the further we get into the deep end, the more wonderful it comes. It really does build toward a climax even the next 3 days, so anticipate that. Okay, so it's right now, what time? 3 o'clock.
Let's be back here by...